From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network. Gen's editor-in-chief John Sterling talks to Robert Shook, author of the book Miracle Medicines, Seven Life-Saving Drugs, and the People Who Created Them.
Robert Shook has authored 48 books, including The IBM Way and Hardball Selling. His most recent book is entitled Miracle Medicines, Seven Life-Saving Drugs, and the People Who Created Them. It's published by Penguin Group USA. Shook was able to gain access to some of the top pharmaceutical companies in the world, where he talked to researchers about how they are transforming scientific theories into new life-saving medicines. Bob, what motivated you to write Miracle Medicines?
Well, John, there's been so much negative publicity about this industry, and I've written business books before. This is actually my 52nd book, and I wanted to find out, you know, what's the true story behind these companies, because they're so important to us. I don't think there's anything made for human consumption that's more important than medicines. And, you know, to see an industry like this get such negative publicity, I wanted to see, well, what's going on here. So I approached seven different pharmaceutical companies. I asked them if I could come in, interview their scientists, find out, you know, how they make the medicines, tell their stories. And, yeah, that's what I did. And I found that these are remarkable people and a remarkable industry and not deserving of the negative publicity that it's gotten. There was a survey taken while I was writing the book, or before I started writing the book, actually. It said that the least admired companies in the whole world were the oil companies. Second were the pharmaceutical companies, even less esteemed than the tobacco companies. Tobacco companies make products that kill people and make them very, very sick. And, you know, this industry that makes products that makes people better, that relieves pain, suffering, and prolongs life, you know, we're the least admired other than oil companies.
Now, despite the plethora of life-saving and life-improving drugs that pharmaceutical companies discover and market, including the ones that you've written about, and we'll talk about that. As you say, Big Pharma tends to have a negative image, especially among the general public. What do you think is responsible for this image?
Well, a lot of people think they make too much money, and they do make a lot of money, but they have to because it takes $1 billion today to bring the average medicine out. You have to go through all the things they have to go through, the R&D. They have to go through these clinical tests, which are the most expensive part. And then another part that's very, very expensive is they have to actually prove to the FDA that they have the ability to manufacture the medicine before they could get approved, which means in some cases, like in the case of Remicade, which is a biotech medicine made by a division of Johnson & Johnson, they actually had to build a plant. The plant cost about $400 or $500 million just to build the plant. Now, this same company built a plant for another medicine several years before that in the final stages wasn't approved. They found something wrong, and they spent $600 million in that plant, all for naught. So there's just tremendous expenses involved. The average person doesn't realize this. They see a little pill that fits in their hand, and they say, how could that pill, you know it's so small, how could it cost $20 or $60 or $200? Well, it's all the thousands, tens of thousands of people that are being paid to make these medicines, and all the tests and the manufacturing plants, and it's just an enormous expense.
Now, in light of this negative perception that these companies sometimes have to deal with, how difficult was it for you to get seven of the top pharmaceutical companies in the world to agree to allow you to conduct interviews with their top scientists and executives?
Well, it took months and months before I could get one company to agree. It was so difficult. At times I said to my wife, I said, I'm just going to throw the towel and it's impossible to see these companies. I once wrote a book called The Chief Executive Officers, where I went out and interviewed the chairmen of General Motors, AT&T, Prudential, DuPont, General Electric, American Express, the biggest companies in the world at the time. All I did to write that book was I called up somebody in public relations. I told them I was writing this book. I'd like to come in and talk to their CEOs. And the doors were wide open to me. I got interviews within days after I made the phone call. Here it took weeks and months, and many times they never even returned my phone calls.
Now, getting back to your book, what were some common themes underlying the successful development of the seven drugs that you write about?
Well, I never met so many brilliant people in my life. I never knew human beings could be so smart. I mean, these guys, they're just off the charts, they're so intelligent. And, you know, I was interviewing people that had all kinds of degrees, all kinds of, you know, graduate degrees and PhDs and MDs and guys who went to school for 14, 15, 16, 18 years. And a lot of these people were MDs and were chemists. And the chemists could have gone to work for a petroleum company and probably made three times as much money as they would make for a pharmaceutical company. An MD could go into a private practice and make several times more than what pharmaceutical companies pay. But these people really wanted to do good for humankind. And they were working for these companies for less money, working 70, 80-hour weeks, just because they wanted to do something good in this world, make a difference in the world. I was very, very impressed with the high quality of people that work for these companies.
Now, you write that in interviewing people working for Big Pharma, you observed a determined eagerness to do the right thing. What is the right thing?
Well, if you're a physician, you know, your job is to relieve pain and suffering, save lives. And to these people that work for these pharmaceutical companies that are in the labs, they think the right thing is to be working there so they can not just save lives on a one-to-one basis or have somebody sit across from them when they're examining them and be able to treat that one person, relieve his pain, his suffering, but do it on a mass scale. So to them, that was the right thing. And the more lives they could benefit, you know, the more right it was. And that's what motivated them to work for these pharmaceutical companies. Very impressed with people like that. You know, people that are, you know, frankly, underpaid. I mean, you could see an athlete, professional athlete that plays baseball or plays in the NBA, and he can make more in one day than these men make in a year. An athlete can make more, you know, in a season than these guys make in their lifetime. These guys are so much more talented, have so much more to give to the world. But, you know, that's the way the system works, and they're willing to do it because they feel it's the right thing to do.
All right. Now, how do Big Pharma executives view their responsibility of providing safe and effective therapeutics at a reasonable price while simultaneously trying to maximize company profits? And I guess I could add, what do they consider a reasonable price?
A reasonable price is hard to define. There's a very thin line that they have to walk on. It's a difficult balancing act because they have to be able to make enough money so their companies, you know, can profit, because they're, you know, these are companies owned by shareholders and they have to satisfy their shareholders. But at the same time, they have to do what they think is right. And if they overcharge people and people can't afford the medicines, you know, that'll hurt society, and they can't make money either. So they have to determine, you know, what could they charge and still make money. They have to make money because it costs them so much to make these products. And people don't realize that for every one medicine, it might cost $1 billion to bring out, like I said before, there might be dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds, that this company has thousands and thousands of scientists working on that never make it to the marketplace, never earn a dime. So they have to pay for those too. So there's tremendous cost involved for the medicines that don't make it, because some of those medicines have scientists that work, you know, for years and years, and they have to pull the plug because it doesn't work. They give a test and it gets to the test where they test on human beings, and you know, it could work in lab animals, it could work in the lab, but it doesn't work you know, on human beings. So just tremendous expenses, so they have to figure out a way to be able to pay for those expenses too. Now, people say, well, you know, they make too much money. It's not right. They shouldn't be making any money. Well, if they don't make any money, then they wouldn't exist. If you didn't have the pharmaceutical companies exist, who would make medicines for us? There'd be only two other sources. You'd have universities, or you'd have the government. We all know that neither one of those would be able to manufacture medicines and distribute them. They might be able to do some lab work, but that's just the very beginning part. So you really need these pharmaceutical companies. You need them to be healthy. They have to make money, or else, you know, there wouldn't be any pharmaceutical companies.
Now, in one chapter in your book, you call Remicade, Johnson & Johnson's treatment for immune-mediated disorders, a miracle biotech medicine.
Remicade.
Remicade, right. Why so?
Well, this is a medicine that you take by infusion. Now, there's different ways you can take medicine. You can take it by a pill, which goes, you know, through the digestive system and so forth, and, you know, it gets through all kinds of things in the body before it actually gets to the part that it's going to work on. You could take shots. You could inhale medicines like you do for certain asthma diseases and respiratory diseases. With Remicade, you actually take it by infusion. You go to the doctor's office, and he'll give you an infusion. It may take a half hour, an hour. You'll take it one time. You go back 2 weeks later. You'll take it again. Then you go back a month later. Then you go back every other month. But it's a medicine that goes right into the blood system, and it fights immune disorders. Now, when they first came out with our Remicade, it was to treat immune disorders, and they got an indication to treat Crohn's disease. Then they got an indication to treat rheumatoid arthritis. Then they got an indication to treat psoriasis. Now, somebody would say, what does any of those three diseases have to do with each other, that one medicine could, you know, be a cure for all those? And Remicade is, because they're all related to the immune system. The amazing thing about this medicine is, and we talk about expenses and so forth, is how they manufacture it. I visited the manufacturing plant, and it was probably easier to get in Fort Knox than get a tour through this manufacturing plant because it's so well guarded. The reason why it's so well guarded is because they have to keep out germs because Remicade is a medicine that they actually farm cells that make a protein that goes into the body that attaches to other proteins in the body that fights off diseases like the ones I just mentioned. So to see them actually being able to make this type of medicine and then be able to, you know, have it so it's so safe because, you know, these are living organisms and because they are living, they're subject to disease too. Just be very, very careful what they're fed, what no air gets in there, that anybody that enters, you have to go through all kinds of systems, put on different types of clothes and so forth. It took me over 45 minutes to suit up to actually be able to enter into this plant. That's how, you know, careful they are about germs and disease getting in there. And it's just, to me, an amazing thing to be able to see human beings can make products like that that can go into the human body and inhibit disease from spreading that causes pain and suffering and death.
Now, in another chapter in your book, you say that Lipitor, Pfizer's cholesterol-lowering medicine that is the world's best-selling drug, almost did not happen. Can you tell us why Lipitor was in danger of not making it to the doctor's office? And is there a broader message from the Lipitor case for other companies developing new drugs?
Well, with Lipitor, they started actually working on it back in 1981, 82. I think it approved until, it must have been 93, 94, 95. It took, you know, 15 years practically to get this medicine approved so they could start selling it. And at the time when they were making it, they were working on different molecules, and they had two compounds that they thought were better. And those were getting all the attention, and the compound that became Lipitor, they weren't so sure with it. And sometimes when they have two, they get all the attention, they put it into what they call their compound library, and it gets put into a file, and it never resurfaces again. They just get lost. You know, they're shelved forever. It almost happened to Lipitor, but then they had trouble with their two proteins that they were working on that were actually their first choices. And that was a big disappointment in the company. And then as a backup for the third statin, they said, well, let's go with Lipitor, which at the time wasn't called Lipitor. It was just given a number. It was CI-981. And usually they just get a number and they didn't even give a name. Probably was given a generic name called Avastatin, and then later became known as Lipitor. But they almost canned it all together. And then, you know, there were some really dedicated scientists, one by the name of Bruce Roth, another one by the name of Newton. Gosh, I can't think of his name, but I know him so well, too. And anyway, it was Newton that went to a presentation, gave a pitch to management, said, you got to test this drug on humans. They found that some medicines, some drugs, don't test well on lab animals because lab animals aren't humans. And these scientists were so convinced that this would work on humans, even though it didn't work real well on lab animals, that, you know, they packed it up down their hands and knees and begged management to at least test it because they spent all this money, all these years on this medicine and try it on human beings. Well, they actually took 20 different employees from the company and actually tested Lipitor on these 20 people. And they said, if it works, if we see some favorable results, we'll go further. That was an early stage of the clinical trials. And if that works, we'll go further. Well, they tried it on these 20 different people, and the guys were flabbergasted how wonderful this medicine worked. Guys' cholesterol that were at 250, 300 went down, it was cut in half. They never saw anything like it. One of the things about a medicine like Lipitor is, you could take it, and it doesn't take weeks or months to see results. You're able to see results very quickly.
And you go into this in your chapter about there were some stops and starts here. What, in terms of the development of this drug and the problems they encountered in sort of getting it to market, what might other drug companies learn from how Pfizer handled getting Lipitor from the bench to the market?
Well, the lesson is that sometimes a medicine won't work well with lab animals. And if you have scientists that really have done their work and they have a passion for it and they just won't give up and they have this intuition that's telling them go ahead, push on, don't give up when you meet some stumbling blocks. Sometimes that's what it takes. That's what it took with Lipitor. Now they had no idea at the time that this would be a big blockbuster drug like it is. This one medicine last year generated $13 billion in sales. I mean, that's a mind-boggling number for one particular medicine. There are major corporations in America that don't do $13 million in sales and employ several hundred thousand people. So, this is just such a home run, and they almost gave up on it. And sometimes, you just have to go with your guts and what you believe in, what your people believe in, and you try things, even though it might cost you a few million dollars more, you're in a certain place where you spend so much money, you say, let's go on and see what happens. Now, there's some good reasons why management might say no to scientists. They may say, well, even though you guys have this passion and you want this medicine to come out and you work so hard on it and you believe in it, we've already been working on it for 8, 10, 12 years, and XYZ company and ABC company have been doing the same thing, and they've already come out with theirs, and at best we'll be able to compete against theirs, and because they're the first man out there, we're not going to be able to succeed. There's an old expression, the first man gets the oyster, the second man gets the shell. That often happens with medicines. If you have one medicine that's pretty much like another one, the second one doesn't do very well.
I see. Now, toward the end of your book, you write that major pharmaceutical advances will continue to take place only in an environment that promotes harmony among science, industry, and government. Now, this can often be a daunting challenge. How can such a harmonious environment not only be created, but also maintained?
Well, I think what has to happen is you have to have the public be better informed. And that's only going to come with when the pharmaceutical companies could use the PR people to tell their story better. I think they do a terrible job in telling their story. I think one of the reasons why they do a bad job is because they're afraid to say anything because they have so many lawyers that are on their staff that are saying, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do this. This is one of the reasons why I couldn't get in to see them. Attorneys were saying, you can't have an outsider come in and talk to you because you don't know what he's going to write. And then they were paranoid. They had to stop being so paranoid and let them go out and tell their story, the good parts of what they do, and let the public understand that. They're hearing all the bad stories, but not the good stuff they're doing. And you have to have good PR. You have to have the public be well informed. If you don't have that, then you have the public, coming to legislators and saying, these companies charge too much money. You got to curtail their profits. And if public opinion goes against them and legislation is passed that prohibits them from doing what they do, that would be a disaster. We've made so much progress in the last 25 years in medicine. If you let these companies do their thing, go on and have a free reign, do the R&D and manufacture products and do what they do well, we'll have cures for disease that we can't even imagine.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. Now we'd like your thoughts on some of the topics discussed during the podcast. Please go to www.genengnews.com/blog and answer the following question. Despite the number of life-saving drugs developed and marketed by pharmaceutical companies, the industry often gets bad press and frequently gets a nod of disapproval from the public. Why do you think this is the case? And what can the pharmaceutical industry do to avoid being perceived negatively? Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast, or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghaus saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.